Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio. Good morning, darling. It's always good to hear your voice. Okay, one of these days I will meet you and you'll turn out to be a 75-year-old grandmother. And I'm 73, so that might work. But forgetting all of that, okay. Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Schwartz. I'm a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School. I'm here with my compatriot, Brendan Berry, who is also just the same, a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School, excuse me. And I'm supposed to tell you all, okay, that what Brendan and I say or the opinions that we render are our thoughts, our feelings, our opinions alone. They are not necessarily the opinions of the WMU Cooley Law School administration or its faculty individually or at large. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How are you
today? That was a cue, Brendan. You're supposed to say something. Okay.
What, you didn't? Hello?
I thought he said it all. Didn't he say it all?
Okay. There was this pregnant pause. Okay, there's a cue. Jump on it.
Yeah. You know me. You know me. If you ask me how I'm doing this morning, it's going to take me a minute to think about that, right? I mean, I'm not just going to out here with the, I'm doing great, because I like to be truthful, you know?
Okay, I'll tell you.
Brendan
I'm
has always
ask
been
you how you feel.
You could sense that right away.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you right now how you feel. And while you're thinking about it, good morning, Desi. How are you today?
Good morning. Good morning. Okay. What a pleasure. This is not fair. I mean, you talk about politics and you talk about all this stuff. It's not supposed to be so jovial.
Well, yeah, but I have to start it out that way. If I start out depressing, everybody will have to take a Prozac by the end of the show.
Oh, that's right.
So mm-hmm. I started out this way. You know how it goes. Okay, you ready to answer my question now, Brendan?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. Actually, I'm looking at a National Weather Service radar map, and it looks like we'll be spared down here. But there's quite a bit of weather moving across the country. It looks like New York is in the path. Has he?
Yeah.
When are you guys going to get
we're
hit?
We're going to get it. I think sometime tonight or
okay.
tomorrow.
Good for you. Good for you.
There'll be something to do.
Then.
Yeah.
But there's nothing prettier than Times Square at Christmas time with all that snow on the ground before it turns mm-hmm. dirty black, okay, when it's white and it's fluffy. Okay? You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. It's beautiful there. So it's a good white Christmas. Maybe it'll last long enough. You'll have a white Christmas. That would be nice. We start out the show after we get done laughing. We start out the show every week with a segment that we call What Do You Really Think? And Brendan and I just pick a subject and take off on it. And I have to thank this person I'm about to talk about for giving me something really to talk about. I mean, we have a lot of things to talk about, but this is really kind of important. There was a dinner over the weekend. The young Republicans of New York, like the gangs of New York are getting together to do a battle. The young Republicans of New York had a dinner. And two of the guests were Steve Bannon, you know, the guy that's going to go to prison pretty shortly. Okay?
Yeah.
And Marjorie Taylor Greene herself. And she was giving a speech to these people, and everybody was just – you could tell by the sounds in the back. It was kind of a jovial thing. But she gets up there, and during her speech, she says – and I'm paraphrasing a little bit because I can't give the exact quote – that everything that happened on January 6th is being blamed on her and Steve Bannon. And then she follows up with it by saying, But you can believe that if Bannon and I were running that, we had planned it, we would have won.
Wow.
And there would have been a lot of weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And there would have been a lot of weapons. That's what she said. And what do you hear in that room?
Applause.
Laughter. Joviality.
Oh.
They thought that was funny in the context that, yeah, she's right, and it's kind of funny that she's saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for those of you who have not heard us say it before, she's a member of Congress, right? Her oath of office says, I will preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Domestic.
That is her oath of office, and she is saying that if she had planned this, I would have done it better. We would have won. We would have overthrown the government because we would have brought guns and started killing people. That's what she's saying. This is the woman who is going to tell the soon-to-be probably Speaker of the House, McCarthy, Kevin McCarthy, is going to tell him what to say. She's going to tell him what to do. She's going to tell him when he goes to the bathroom how many sheets of toilet paper he's allowed to use.
Mm-hmm.
This is the woman that Republicans are empowering, and you did not hear anyone from Congress in any way, shape, or form criticize those comments. I don't know what the hell is going to happen over the next 2 years if she's in charge. And she believes that she is in charge. This whole idea that her insurrectionist buddies are going to vote against Kevin, that's not going to happen. Because somehow or another, she's going to convince them to vote for Kevin. Really? Like you are not already committed to that? But it sure looks good every time she walks into Kevin's office and interrupts any meeting she wants to by just walking in the door and screaming and yelling at Kevin over something he's done because he's there because of her. This is a dangerous, dangerous woman who does not believe there are consequences to pay for being a Nazi, for being a fascist, for trying to overthrow the United States government. No consequences at all for her Lord and Savior, the former guy himself, DJ Trump. I like that. He's a DJ now. DJ Trump. And the sad part is that she and Paul Gosar and Louis Gohmert and Banks and what's his name, the one that filed against McCarthy, can't remember his name at the moment, Gates and all the other members of the insurrection caucus. Okay, that there is no price to pay for being disloyal to the Constitution. No price at all. We are invulnerable. We run the House. The one thing they really want, above everything else, is a change in the rules that will allow for the recall of the Speaker by a majority vote. of the Republican caucus. Like in England, when the part of the Conservative Party says we've lost confidence, and they vote out their own leader,
mm-hmm.
which means you have to change, for example, the prime ministership. That's what they want. They want chaos, utter and complete chaos. Here's what I want. On January 3rd, they will, en masse, all members of the House will raise their right hand and take the oath. I want a camera on each and every member of the insurrection caucus, the top seven or eight. I want to see if all they do is raise their right hand. I want to see if they speak the words that they're supposed to speak in being sworn in. I want to see if they do that. And if they don't say the words, then they have not been sworn in. They are not entitled to their commissions. And, in fact, they should be investigated for fraud upon the American people, and they're not authorized to be members of the House of Representatives. And I want actions filed continuously against all of them. If it declared, one, that Kevin McCarthy did not properly get elected by 218 members of the House of Representatives because their votes don't count, because they're not members of Congress. And I want Democrats to push that criteria, because remember, at that point, if you knock out seven or eight of those people, Democrats have the majority in the House.
Mm-hmm.
They want to play games. They don't want to take the oath because they don't want to swear to God, because they're all good religious people. Okay, they don't want to swear to God to something that they don't believe in and that they're not going to do. I want a camera on each and every one of them. And if their lips don't move, then they didn't take the oath. And I want them out. I want them removed from the chamber. They have no right to sit. And when they lie and say they did take the oath, show them the film. And tell them to get out. Because I don't think they'll raise their right hand and swear to God to those things. Because the Christian right people won't like that. But I think all they're going to do is raise their right hand, and then they're going to sit down. And they're never going to speak the words. And thus they are not properly sworn in as members of Congress, and I want them thrown out. End of story. I'm not going to repeat it again.
Mm.
And that's what I really think.
Mm-hmm. It is almost more offensive will be if they do take the oath, right? I mean, and swear to do something that they know that they won't actually uphold. Not sure which would be worse, you know, just don't take the oath and sit down and at least be honest about it, or take the oath knowing you're going to violate it. But it's a very interesting conundrum that's where we are with the Republican Party. Those are the only two choices, right? Either be honest
and
don't
take
the
oath. That is the only two choices.
Right? Yeah, either be honest and don't, you can't, or take the oath, know you're lying the entire time. And indeed, that is, yeah, that's where we're at.
That's where we're at.
A somewhat related note, while we're talking about our institutions. Jeff, when you and I talked before we came on here, I had just seen a headline about Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court Justice, obviously, and having attended a certain soiree that is raising eyebrows and new concerns about ethics on the Supreme Court. And it brings to mind a broader picture of what's going on right now with the Supreme Court. I'm sure you've heard the reporting, and Pezzi has probably as well. the American right wing and particularly evangelical right of the political spectrum has been working for many, many decades to nurture, to create and nurture a truly right-wing theocratic judiciary. To that, they've learned their lessons on the political right about, you know, there have been some very famous appointments to the courts, like Justice Souter, Justice Anthony Kennedy, just to name a few, who were up as Stevens as well, appointed by conservative Republican presidents, and then turned out, once they had lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court, turned out to have quite open minds and to be amenable to progressive arguments and to regard the Constitution as a living, breathing document that was meant to evolve with time, right? So we can't have that. If you're a true right-winger, you can't have judges and justices who think that way. And that's why the political right founded things like the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society, right, to get into our law schools, to get into our law culture, to start cultivating these ideas about originalism, right, where the Constitution never changes, this meaning never changes over time. We're stuck eternally to 1868 or 1791. It was a very deliberate project. And we have finally arrived at a time when they have, because of Donald Trump's three appointments, and we all know the controversies around all of those, finally arrived at a time where they have not just a majority on the Supreme Court, but a super majority on the Supreme Court of 6-3 with one occasional waverer being John Roberts, right, who occasionally joins the court's more rational branch for institutionalist reasons. And what we see now, I'm going to use the word nurture again because that's what's going on. Now that the political right, and as I said, especially the evangelical right, has what it wants on this court, they are trying very hard to protect it, to shield it, to ensure that these six judges, especially the five most conservative justices, do exactly what they were put there to do. And to that end, they are surrounding members of the court. It's an open, and people are starting to talk about it now. I think it's fascinating how right out in the open this is, that conservatives want the justices to know in their personal lives, in their daily lives, in their social interactions, in their churches, in the groups of people they associate with, they want these justices to know that they are surrounded by people who are praying for them. They're surrounded by people who support them. They're surrounded by people who, as I heard one reporter put it, that they know they're surrounded by people who thank God, literally, thank God that these people are where they are. And they want these justices to feel supported. So they are keenly aware, the political right is keenly aware that these are humans, that they are an asset to the political right that must be guarded, protected, and nurtured. And that's why we're seeing, I think, more and more of the associations with these justices. You know, the story that recently came out about Justice Alito, that he's at dinner with religious right supporters and discussing the Hobby Lobby case and who's going to win that. The most recent article I just saw this morning was about Brett Kavanaugh attending a Christmas party. And I don't begrudge, let me be clear about this. I don't begrudge any Supreme Court justice or any other public figure for that matter, their right, you know, their privilege, whatever you want to say, to maintain a social life. We are social beings, right? I understand that you can't close yourself off from the world just because you're on the Supreme Court. You're going to go to cocktail parties. You're going to go to coffee with people. You're going, okay, I get it. But it's pretty strange, the company that Supreme Court justices tend to find themselves in these days. You know, you can be judged for the company you keep. And so I want to take a look here at the guest list at this party. At Matt and Mercy Schlapp's Christmas party. The guest list included a Justice of the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, Matt Gaetz, we all know Matt Gaetz, Sean Spicer, Sebastian Gorka, your favorite, Jeff, Stephen Miller, and his wife.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. Oh, yeah.
Yep. Eric Prince, he of the international arms transactions, right, for a right-wing activist, was there as well. Just going to read a couple of tweets, and then I'll move on. Tristan Snell.
Don't leave out Matt Schlapp. Explain who Matt Schlapp is.
Yeah, Matt Schlapp was the host.
He's the chairman of the Conservative Political Action Committee, known as CPAC.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, I'm going to steal a couple of tweets here, and then I want to turn it over to see what you think about it. But here's from Tristan Snell. Says Brett Kavanaugh was just at a holiday party with Matt Gaetz, Stephen Miller, and Eric Prince, all of whom may soon be implicated in various federal crimes.
Well, you know who Eric Prince's sister is, don't you?
Yeah.
No.
Betsy DeVos.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. He's the one that ran the group of mercenaries who worked in Iran and made millions and millions of dollars supplying mercenaries.
Yep. Right, right.
Okay. That's who Eric Prince is.
That's who Eric Prince is. So he was there. This is a short guest list, by the way. There's not, you know, there wasn't a lot of people there. David Korn. Everybody knows David Korn, tweeted, Kavanaugh chilling with leading election deniers and top supporters of a man who incited political violence and was called for the termination of the U.S. Constitution. Nothing to see, just move along. And there's been much reaction like that. Again, do I have a problem with a Supreme Court justice going to a Christmas party? I don't have any problem with that at all. Do you have to wonder what a U.S. Supreme Court justice is doing in the same room with Stephen Miller, Eric Prince, and Matt Gaetz? You have to wonder. You have to wonder how Brett Kavanaugh could have allowed that to happen, and you have to wonder how the members of this court can continue to disregard the optics of what has been going on. Sorry for a long-winded what I really think.
That's
but
okay.
When it comes to the institutional health of the Supreme Court and its deterioration,
right.
That's what I'm really thinking about this morning.
Okay. Let's take a look at something. And I talked about this yesterday to a class from the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, that the drop in the trust that the people have in the judicial branch of the federal government is profound. Absolutely profound. Gallup has been doing polls on this for 30 years, more. No, 40, 50 years. The first one is in 1972 when they judged that they did the poll, 66% of the people trusted the judicial branch. In 74, it went up to 71%. Then it took a dive in 1976, 63%. You have to remember what was happening then. And it slowly, by 1997, got back up to 71, and as high as 80% during the 90s, then took a big dive during the early 2000s to 65%. We thought that was bottom. It wasn't. In 2015, it was 53%. It rose, okay, during the years to 68%, around that between 2017 and 2019. And in the last 2 years, alone, it has gone down 20% to only 47% of the American public trust the judicial branch of the federal government.
Oh, my God.
Now, the problem is that represents the entirety of the judicial branch. It doesn't represent what people think of the United States Supreme Court. And only 25%, 25%, only 1 in 4 Americans trust the United States Supreme Court or hold it in any regard. 25%. And it is, in fact, well, actually, according to the chart I'm looking at now, I apologize, the job approval of the Supreme Court is at 40%. 58%, that's almost two-thirds, disapprove. And that's been climbing exponentially since 2020, that disapproval, which was at 39%, and the approval was at 60%. Of the Supreme Court alone, we are a nation of laws, and being a nation of laws, it is the respect we have for our courts that make people obey their decrees. The courts don't have soldiers. The courts don't have armies. The courts don't have an enforcement arm. It is respect for what they say and the rule of law. What happens when people disapprove of or don't trust the people that are issuing the decrees that are the law? This is a total and complete undermining of one of the most necessary branches of government, which control the other two. And we're going to talk more about how that may be coming to end for another reason not too far from now. We're talking about a very serious issue that goes beyond election denials. This is unbelievably serious. Right now, according to these polls, 47% of the American public don't trust the judiciary. And yet, for some reason, members of this court don't care what people think. They flounce, whatever the word is, okay, this misconduct that would get any other judge sanctioned or thrown off the bench. Whether it was Scalia going hunting and having his trip paid for by people who have matters pending before the Supreme Court, whether it's Justice Thomas continuing to remain on cases that involve his wife and her insurrectionist ways, which makes him an insurrectionist too. What these people tell everybody else out there is, we don't care about the Constitution. We don't care. We care about our Bible, but we don't care about the Constitution. We don't care what you think about us, because we have a lifetime appointment. We can do whatever we want to. You go to a party with people who deride and do not believe in the Constitution, and you are what? sworn to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And you're in the company of domestic enemies. How do you do that? How does Sam Alito go and sit with his friends in the evangelical world and tell them that Hobby Lobby is going to win? And then claim he is the victim of a leak of his opinion in Dobbs. I'm sorry, you leaked it. And you leaked it because Kavanaugh was about to abandon you and make it a plurality opinion, not a majority opinion, and that scared the hell out of you, so you decided to corner him into remaining in your camp by going public. But you claim to be the victim. You're not Sam Alito. You're a political animal. And you justify your political decisions with absolute and total ignorance of the true facts of the case or the law that existed. And when I say ignorance, I mean ignorance. You don't care. This court is out of control. Completely out of control. And Congress, unfortunately, has never taken the steps to impose upon them a standard of ethical behavior. Now, the only way to enforce it, of course, is to impeach them, but at least they could have started proceedings against, at this point, could have started proceedings against Clarence Thomas. There's no issue about that. This is the sad part of what we're seeing. And it's got to stop. There's got to be a way. These people have to realize, why don't you just take the Constitution and the six of you go out there and just burn it in front of everybody on the steps of the Supreme Court? Say, this: we're deciding that the Constitution is unconstitutional and therefore unenforceable. How about that? I'm sorry. It has to stop. End of story. Has to stop. I don't know how you make it stop, but it's got to stop. This is just really sad stuff. Terrible, horrible stuff. Let's move on because my blood pressure is going up. There. Let's move on. What else we got to talk about today? We got lots to talk about. What do you want to talk about?
Oh, let's see. How about you know more about this than I do. Well, let's talk about Jack Smith. What's Jack Smith up to, our special counsel in the Donald Trump cases?
You know, this week, last week, Jack filed a motion to have Trump found in contempt of court.
Mm-hmm.
Really what it was is a motion for a rule to show cause, because that's the only thing the judge could do. If Trump wasn't there, even though he was represented, he could not be held in criminal contempt. He has to be present. So the judge is basically being asked to issue what's known as a rule to show cause. It's a rule. Basically what it is a demand by the court that the defendant appear. And now the burden is on him to show cause why he should not be held in contempt of court. And there's sufficient grounds to hold him in contempt. Tell me why I shouldn't hold you in contempt of court. That's the question. And the press was denied access to the hearing. It was a closed courtroom. It was a locked courtroom. There were press outside the door, but the doors were insulated, as was the courtroom, and they couldn't hear a sound. And the hearing lasted not very long, and when the hearing was over, the lawyers were escorted out a back entrance to the courthouse. They didn't even surface outside the courtroom. They were gone before the press even knew the hearing was over. And that gave me a hint of what really happened. And the judge denied that request for a show cause order, but everybody talks about that the government lost, this is a bad loss, it was an overreach. It really wasn't. Here's what it really was. It was an attempt to get a show cause order and maybe a contempt order to help them in their obstruction of justice charges. To have something to keep Trump off the stand, being convicted of criminal contempt for exactly what he's on trial for. Well, not exactly, because then it would be double jeopardy. There's additional elements. That's a technical thing. But they didn't care if he went to jail. They didn't care if he got fined. They wanted to be able, if they ever cross-examined him, to point this out to the jury if he took the stand. And I think I know what happened. I'm thinking like a judge now. I used to be one, so I'm going to think like a judge for a minute. And the truth of the matter is what happened in that court, in that hearing, was you had a mightily ticked off judge who I think looked at the government and said, first of all, I'm not going to issue a rule to show cause to have Mr. Trump walk in the door and said, we're doing the best we can. We don't find people in contempt when they're doing the best they can. Nor am I going to make a finding that he didn't know what was going on, so therefore I can't find him in contempt of court. Because there is that possibility. What I'm going to tell you, government, right now is I'm not here as a tool of the government. I'm not here to make your case better evidentiary-wise. I'm not here to give a preview of what I might or might not do if he gets convicted of any charges involving these documents. What I'm going to tell you now, government, is do your business or get off the pot. From what I've seen so far, there is sufficient enough evidence for you to indict. And probably more than enough to go to trial on. So you make up your mind what you're going to do. I'm tired of these shenanigans from both sides. Indict him, don't indict him. I care, but I don't care. You are not going to get me removed from the case because I already made a finding against him. You make up your mind. You decide. And do it quickly. This hearing is over. You will be escorted out the back. Do not comment about anything I said in this hearing. This is a closed hearing. It will remain closed. Do you all understand? I'm gagging you. Now go out the back door and don't tell the press anything. That's what I think happened. This judge has a history in the matters revolving around January 6th and other matters involving Donald Trump and his administration of not being the friendliest judge they've ever been in front of. In other words, it is an Aileen Cannon. She's quite the opposite. And she was not going to get thrown off this case for finding him in contempt and saying, you've already judged this case, Judge, you can't be fair. This was a bad move by the government. It was a good move if they needed the help. They don't need the help.
Mm-hmm.
Just do what you're supposed to do. Either indict him or return the damn documents to him. It's that simple. Now, everybody knows it isn't going to happen before the first of the year now. Yeah, it's not going to. Hey, Merry Christmas. I'm Santa Claus, and I'm here to serve you with process, Mr. Trump. You are to surrender on the 2nd of January in Washington. Hey, Merry Christmas. Bye. That's not going to happen. But I think that's what happened. That's why nobody's talking. Did you hear anything from Trump's people about what a wonderful victory they had? Did you hear anything from the government about how disappointed they were? I didn't. Did you?
Crickets.
Brendan, did you hear anything?
Crickets. I heard crickets.
Crickets. Crickets. And that's the biggest thing, sneaking them out the back so they don't have to talk to the press and telling them they can't talk to the press. That's what I think happened. And that's the biggest hint that tells me this judge has said, I've had enough. Do something, don't do something.
Mm-hmm.
Your choice. And I haven't heard one person say that on TV. Have you?
No. Nope.
Ken Delaney keeps talking about what a terrible loss this was for the government. Inconsequential. Totally inconsequential.
No,
but
it's a good
they
thing.
Don't know
I,
what
I,
goes on behind. Go ahead.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I think the judge's instinct, you know, that you reflect is something I had not heard among the commentators and the media. It's compelling that if you're a judge in this case, the last thing you want to do is become part of the story. And it makes a lot of sense to me that the judge would say, you do your job, let me do mine, and I'm not going to do yours for you. And that's not bad news for the government. It's just an indication from the judge that you've got everything you need. Now go ahead and bring it. And, you know, we've all been in conversations with judges like that, where usually when you're in chambers, right, with the other side present, and the judge tells everybody what the judge thinks of the case. I once had a judge tell the prosecutor, in my presence, so, you know, nothing ex parte going on or anything, but the judge tell the prosecutor, you know, your case is so full of holes, you can drive a truck through it, and I have every confidence that defense counsel will do just that. Sometimes the judge is going to tell you, look, let's decide how much time we're going to waste here.
The great part about all of this is that things are starting to happen in such rapid-fire order. That is, one analysis said that the moment of truth is fast approaching for both Trump and the DOJ.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, DOJ's got to blank or get off the pot. And if they decide to blank, then Donald Trump is in for a hellacious 2023.
Yeah.
And he has suffered loss after loss after loss in court as he tries to narrow or exclude things, and it just keeps piling up on him. His oath keepers, who I believe the head of which is looking at life, basically life in prison for him, and his lieutenant, because it's a 20-year sentence, and he's old enough that it could be a life sentence for him, okay, they don't want to spend the rest of their life in prison. I still think they'll fold like a cheap suit and hand up Mark Meadows and hand up Steve Bannon. And if they do that, then those people will fold like cheap suits. Because I don't see Mark Meadows spending the rest of his life in prison. I don't see him doing that. And because it appears that the House is going to shut down anything having to do with him, it now falls upon the DOJ.
Right.
But it's accelerating. Okay? Preet Bharara was correct this weekend when he said, Smith is assembling people who used to be DOJ people who are coming back out of private practice, lucrative private practices, to be part of his team. You don't bring people like that in any more than Morgenthau did in New York, and now the guy who is the prosecutor in Manhattan is sorry those people are gone. You don't assemble people like that to do nothing or to tell you to do nothing. You've already made up your mind to do something. Those people are putting a case together. They're getting ready to go to trial. They issued a subpoena for documents from Brad Raffensperger and other secretaries of state around the country in the battleground states. And you say, what's that got to do with charges involving documents? Well, it may not have much to do with that, but it may have a lot to do with a conspiracy charge to defraud the United States involving his involvement in possible seditious conduct. Did he know what he was doing? What was his motive? All of this being shown against him and the people around him. I mean, a flurry of grand jury subpoenas since Thanksgiving included Stephen Miller, the only Jewish skinhead Nazi in the United States who's Jewish. Two former White House counsels, including Cipollone, have now testified before a grand jury, and I believe during the course of that were required to testify, a judge telling him your claims of executive privilege or attorney-client privilege do not apply, answer the questions, which is all really Cipollone wanted to have happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's ramping up steadily, and it's increasing in pace. This is coming to a head. For Donald, it's like a bad pimple coming to a head. And it's more than the old expression, you're just a pimple on my you-know-what. No. This is something else. This is major stuff. And people are going to start rolling on it. People already have started rolling on it. But they need to do something that they can bring to trial by the middle of next year. And that is the documents case. And if they can bring that to trial, which they can by the middle of the year, and convict him, he's no longer a candidate for president of the United States. That's one of the punishments for being convicted of mishandling of classified documents is you cannot hold an office of trust with the United States anymore, ever. This is bad stuff, and it's really going to start happening. There's just too much. This is like, you know, intelligence operators analyze movements of troops and predict the offensive actions and defensive mm-hmm. abilities, like we've seen in Ukraine. That's what's going on right now. You can read it, you can see it. And now everything that the congressional committee had is now in the hands of the DOJ. Sure makes their life a lot easier, doesn't it? Sworn testimony. They don't even have to take them to a grand jury to have it. So that's Jack Smith lying in a bed in Europe with a broken leg, commanding all of his forces from in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And signing things. Okay. Typing his own 2-paragraph letter on Thanksgiving and signing it.
Yeah.
And filing it with Pacer on Thanksgiving. That was great. Happy
yeah.
Thanksgiving. Okay. So that's what's going on with him. And I think that we're going to see, it won't be before the first of the year. I was hoping it would be, but it won't be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it won't be. But we'll have to suffice with what will happen in January.
Well, you know.
Okay, what else we got?
It's all, everything you just discussed, Jeff, we know, is just a really, it's a big distraction from the real story, from the real threat to America.
Hunter Biden's laptop. I was telling you, there's this comedian, his last name is Terhune, Brett Terhune, and he does a bit that lasts about 3 minutes, and I recommend this to anybody that likes to laugh, okay, and listen to his little bit about no matter, you know, basically saying if you're a truly conservative and you're tired of hearing what the liberals are telling you, anything they do to distract you, you got to know that the greatest threat to American democracy is Hunter Biden's laptop. So no matter what they say, you just answer, Hunter Biden's laptop. It's hysterical. I sent it to, did you finally watch it, Brendan? Have you watched
it yet?
I did. Yet?
I
okay.
Did.
It's funny, right?
That's very good. Very good. He does good stuff.
Yeah, when he sits there and says, I'm home from a late night, and your wife says, where you been? Why do you smell like another woman? Hunter Biden's laptop, and I'm hiding in the glove compartment. It's just great. Okay, yeah. We can talk Hunter Biden's laptop. That's the answer Republicans have for everything that is said to them.
Right.
I'm rubber and you're glue. Everything I say bounces off of me and Hunter Biden's laptop.
Edison. And like all really effective humor. Yeah, the reason it's so funny is because it's so true that you can't say anything to Republicans get ready, everybody, for the next 2 years of a Republican-led Congress, you won't be able to say anything to a Republican in the House of Representatives without the answer being Hunter Biden's laptop. Here it comes. We have 2 years. It's already started. And we got 2 more years of it. And
that's all they can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
That's their big investigation for 2 years. They're going to try to find a way to tag whatever's on his laptop to Joe Biden. Which
mm-hmm.
brings me to a subject we did not talk about. We didn't talk about before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some guy named Elon Musk.
Musk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he bought Twitter. Okay.
Yeah.
And he sent out a tweet regarding Hunter Biden's laptop. Okay, that somehow or another, while all of the matters during the campaign were happening, the rumors of what was on the laptop and all that kind of stuff, that Joe Biden and his campaign made telephone calls to Twitter and Facebook and all this kind of stuff, basically saying that this has nothing to do with me, and it's just being used to distract, and a lot of what they're saying just isn't true. Now, that's what he told them. And so there is a claim by the right that this was suppression of evidence and it was a violation of the First Amendment. Brendan, explain to us how that was not a violation of the First Amendment, please. Because I'm tired of saying it because I've said it so many times for the last week.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why isn't it?
Right. The Constitution, including the First Amendment, cannot be violated by a private party. The Constitution restrains governmental action, and at no time Joe Biden or Joe Biden's campaign may have interacted with Twitter during the election campaign Were they governmental actors? Like any other private person, they can ask Twitter or Facebook or any other social media platform to please not associate themselves with nonsense. And you know what's coming out, I mentioned this last week on this program, and I'm sorry if it sounds untoward, but there are actually now serious reporters who know what was on Hunter Biden's laptop, reporting that the only thing you're going to learn from what was on Hunter Biden's laptop is that Hunter Biden has certain God-given assets that your normal person would not want exposed to the general public. That's what you're going to learn from Hunter. Even conservative commentators now are starting to say, you know, I'm still waiting for the smoking gun here. Okay. You got Elon Musk setting up this big reveal. He hires what used to be a serious reporter named Matt Taibbi to do a Twitter thread that was, first of all, delayed. And second of all, once we started seeing, you know, what Matt Taibbi was, quote, reporting about Hunter Biden's laptop and the quote-unquote Twitter files, was nothing more than private parties associated with a campaign saying you shouldn't be putting that stuff on Twitter. Shocking, I know. Just shocking. That's the big scandal that we're going to be digging into for the next 2 years, and in a nutshell. So, Elon Musk, he's another one of these. He's a disordered personality, and yet another billionaire. I'll give him this much: he probably actually is a billionaire, unlike Donald Trump. But
no,
another one of these rich, another one of these rich guys who thinks that their money means they're smart. Elon Musk is a moron. He's an idiot. He happened upon a good idea about a car, okay? But, you know, the way he's conducted himself lately betrays a lot of underlying issues. And so now we've got this character, you know, trying to get himself onto the public stage with his Twitter file. So that's another buzzword you're going to hear starting now over the next 2 years, right? It'll be Hunter Biden's laptop and Twitter files, the Twitter files, because that sounds like a TV show about a scandal, right? And so they're going to start throwing that language around too. Brace yourself. That's all I can say.
I have to tell you that and to carry that thread just a little bit farther. The problem that we have with all of those things that he says is he starts to argue. First of all, Biden was running for president, and so therefore it was a governmental action. And the answer is he was running for president, but he was not a government employee, wasn't an elected official at the time, nor was his campaign. So that one fails right off the bat. Okay. The second claim is that he still could be if he was doing it at the behest of the government, but he wasn't because the government was Donald Trump, and I guarantee you he was not asking the Biden campaign to try to squash the story. So
right. That
one doesn't work either. But in addition to those two things, they continue to argue that it is a violation of the spirit of the First Amendment to him to have done that. But that's about as a violation of the spirit of the First Amendment that I'm not telling my grandchildren or my children to shut up.
Right.
Okay? Am I violating their First Amendment rights because I, their father said, or grandfather said, shut up? That's the spirit of the First Amendment? No, it's not.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons why I want conservatives to actually succeed at something. I want them to succeed at the repeal of Section 230 of the Communications Act. So now Twitter and everybody else is stuck with monitoring everything that comes up, because if they put it out, they are publishing it, and if they are publishing it, they are responsible for it. And I'd like to see Elon Musk get sued for billions of dollars. I want to see that little you-know-what Zuckerberg get sued for millions of dollars and billions of dollars. Mm. He's already given billions away. Let's have billions more. So I'm in favor of that. I think that there should be a bipartisan move to do away with Section 230. And then conservatives can say goodbye to Parler or Truth Social or any of those others that they put all those lies out on. And by the way, okay, you can say whatever you want. Go to Hyde Park Corner in London. Go to just about any city during the day. You can stand up there and you can say anything you want as long as you don't shout fire in a crowded theater. And asking people to pick up their guns and go shoot members of Congress, that might be shouting fire in a crowded theater.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of things that he needs to understand about the First Amendment. The guy is an ignoramus about anything except for the things that he's interested in. And even this he's interested in, and he has no idea what the First Amendment is. And I can't believe a lawyer hasn't explained it to him. More than one. So that's just a follow-up on what you said. That's all.
Yeah. No, I agree.
So there you go.
And it just happened to take us since that until 11 o'clock. Yep.
Perfect timing.
Yep.
I'll let you have the last word if you got something to say, Brendan.
I got nothing. That was good. So.
Yep. Hezzy, I wish you a good
That's closure.
Weekend. I will.
You too.
Okay. Next Tuesday. Where am I going? Oh, next Tuesday, I do have a doctor's appointment, but I will appear while I'm traveling back and forth and doing stuff. I'll probably be sitting in a waiting room. So I'll be able to participate up till about maybe 5 or 10 of.
Sounds good.
And I'll probably get hauled in there. So otherwise, I'll be here. Brendan, I'll talk to you over the weekend during the remainder of the week and maybe over the weekend.
Yep.
I wish you all the best. Hezzy, take care of yourself.
Both
Don't
of
worry
you.
About you.
All the best to you.
Yep.
Thank
okay.
you.
Take care, Hezzy.
All right.
Yep.
Take care,
take
guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Let's see. We've got a couple of things to cover, and both Brendan and Jeff mentioned this before. U.S. scientists have announced a historic nuclear fusion breakthrough, which is absolutely amazing. Well, it seems that the U.S. Department of Energy announced Tuesday that its researchers have achieved a major scientific breakthrough, quote unquote, regarding nuclear fusion, a technology seen as a possible revolutionary alternative power source. Wow. So scientists have been working for decades to develop nuclear fusion, touted by its many supporters as a clean, abundant, safe source of energy that could eventually allow humanity to break its dependence on the fossil fuels driving a global climate change and crisis. Well, the Energy Department had refused to give any specific details about it, about what it will announce today. According to the United Kingdom-based outlet, researchers at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California had succeeded for the first time in producing a net energy gain from nuclear fusion, meaning that more energy was produced in the reaction than was used to activate it. Wow. So if the achievement is confirmed, that's a true breakthrough moment, which is tremendously exciting. That's what a physicist by the name of Jeremy Chittenden and actually worked with Imperial College London. So it proves that the long sought after goal, the holy grail of fusion, can indeed be achieved. So nuclear power plants around the world currently use fission, the splitting of a heavy atom's nucleus, to produce energy. Fusion, on the other hand, combines two light hydrogen atoms to form one heavier helium atom, releasing a large amount of energy in the process. That's the process that occurs inside stars, including our sun. So on Earth, fusion reactions can be provoked by heating hydrogen to extreme temperatures inside specialized devices. So researchers used the massive National Ignition Facility, 192 ultra-powerful lasers, which are all pointed into a thimble-sized cylinder filled with hydrogen. According to the Financial Times, LLNL scientists recently produced about 2.5 megajoules of energy in a nuclear fusion reaction, or about 120% of the 2.1 megajoules used by the lasers to initiate it. So that result would finally provide proof for the physical principles outlined decades ago by fusion researchers. It would be a success of the science, said Tony Rulston, a lecturer at Cambridge University. Like fusion, or rather like fission, fusion is carbon-free during operation, but has many more advantages. It poses no risk of nuclear disaster and produces much less radioactive waste. However, there is still a long way to go before fusion is viable on an industrial scale. But to turn fusion into a power source, we'll need to boost the energy gains still further, cautions Chittenden. We'll also need to find a way to reproduce the same effect much more frequently and much more cheaply before we can realistically turn this into a power plant, he added. So that could take yet another 20 or 30 years. Eric Lefebvre, the project manager at the French Atomic Energy Commission, advised. So climate experts, however, warn that the world cannot wait that long to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions and limit the worst effects of global warming. So other nuclear fusion projects are also in development around the world, including the major international project known as ITER, which is currently under construction in France. Well, instead of lasers, ITER will use a technique known as magnetic confinement, containing a swirling mass of fusing hydrogen plasma within a massive donut-shaped chamber. This is where it's cutting edge, unbelievable, and it's absolutely breathtaking. What's being accomplished, really, really unbelievable. So we'll see where that goes. Well, there are other things, of course, to cover. The European Union evidently has decided to impose new sanctions on Iran over protest repression. Well, it seems that foreign ministers of European Union countries agreed further sanctions against Tehran over its crackdown on regime critics. An anticipated decision on new measures against Moscow was delayed, however. The European Union foreign ministers on Monday imposed a new round of sanctions against individuals and organizations over human rights abuses in Iran. The bloc also blacklisted 8 drone makers and Air Force commanders' supply of drones to Russia. Quote, we are targeting those responsible for this continued repression against protesters, end quote, the European Union foreign policy chief Josep Borrell had said. Further, he said, also there is the support of Tehran to Russia and responding to the delivery of Iranian drones to Russia. The European Union minister said in a statement, these weapons provided by Iran are being used indiscriminately by Russia against Ukrainian civilian population and infrastructure, causing horrendous destruction and human suffering. While the European Union measures hit top Iranian security officials and a hardline cleric, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB, its director and a news anchor were targeted by the new sanctions for airing forced confessions of detainees. Well, the foreign ministers were also set to discuss the bloc's 9th package of sanctions against Moscow, which would place an additional 200 individuals and entities on the sanctions list. but they postponed the adoption of a new package of measures against Russia over its invasion of Ukraine to later this week. The targets are said to include government ministers, lawmakers, regional governors, and political parties. There are successive rounds of sanctions against Russia that have targeted trade sectors as well as individuals and entities linked to the invasion, war crimes, and the attempted annexation of Ukrainian territory. The ministers, however, agreed to top up a $2 billion, that's a $2.1 billion, €2 billion, but that's $2.1 billion U.S. dollars fund to finance weapon purchases that has been used for Ukraine in recent months. Well, the announcement of new sanctions came as Iran executed a second protester, Majid Reza Ranavard, on Monday. The death in September of an Iranian Kurdish woman by the name of Jinnah Mahsa Amini while in police custody sparked protests across Iran. 22-year-old had been detained for allegedly violating an Islamic dress code that requires women to wear a headscarf. The Western governments have already imposed sanctions against Iran over the protests, with the European Union targeting the inner circle, quote-unquote, of the country's powerful Revolutionary Guard. So the UK and Canada have already announced sanctions in direct response to the use of the death penalty against protesters. And European Union diplomats in October agreed on sanctions against Iran in response to recent drone strikes in Ukraine using hardware believed to be supplied by Tehran. So this is unbelievable. The world is coming together and they're literally fighting evil, which is unbelievable. So, and that's really the bottom line. That's what's going on. Well, let's look at something else, which I think you'll find interesting. European lawmakers have decided to remove a woman by the name of Eva Kaili from office amid a scandal in Qatar. Greek politician Eva Kaili, has been ousted from her position as the European Parliament's vice president. She faces accusations of accepting bribes from Qatari officials. It seems an overwhelming majority of European Parliament members voted to strip Eva Kaili of her position as the body's vice president today. The motion to end her term early was backed by 625 ministers of the European Parliament, while one voted against and two abstained. So the two-thirds majority was required for her to cease being one of the body's 14 vice presidents. The question is, who is she? The 44-year-old Greek social democrat was arrested in Belgium on Friday after allegations she was part of a group accepting bribes from Qatar in exchange for promoting policies friendly to the Gulf state. Kaili has already been suspended from her duties and is in police custody. More information about specific criminal charges against her are due to be announced tomorrow, and Belgian officials have said. So the Greek politician and her three alleged co-conspirators are accused of accepting lavish gifts and large monetary sums from Qatari agents, and the lawmaker has denied any wrongdoing. Kaili's lawyer, Michalis Dimitrakopoulos, said on Tuesday that her position was that she had nothing to do with Qatari bribes. Speaking on Greek television, Dimitrakopoulos said he would not confirm or deny that large sums of cash were found at her home. Belgian prosecutors have said that they found hundreds of thousands of euros at the homes of multiple suspects, as well as in a hotel room. So several European lawmakers have called for Kaili to quit. Quote, given the extent of the corruption scandal, it is the least we could expect of her, Minister of the European Parliament Manon Aubry, who co-chairs the left group, told the Reuters news agency. Well, Manfred Weber of the Conservative European People's Party said, quote, our colleagues at the European Parliament have been deeply shocked. These developments represent a heavy burden. So the question is, what is the impact on Parliament? The scandal has hit the reputation of the European Parliament hard. The body is the European Union's only institution comprised of officials elected directly in the 27 member countries. It has also rocked the Socialists and Democrats, a group in the Assembly, and the second biggest grouping in the 705-member body that brings together center-left parties from across the bloc. So several European Union states, including Germany, said that the 27-nation union's credibility was at stake. Asked whether the European Parliament can repair the situation, Marek Markand, a minister of European Parliament from the Green Party, advised Deutsche Welle that this, quote, this damage cannot be repaired, end quote. It is very easy to lose trust and very hard to regain it. And now I think we cannot ask for the trust of the people. We have just to do our homework, he said, adding that it was time to check which rules should be strengthened and enforced better to prevent such scandals in the future. Yeah, that's the problem. You know, there are all kinds of, I guess, concerns and measures of deterrence that hopefully will dissuade people breaking the law and so on and so forth. However, there are always people who are willing to accept money and cash in order to be able to break the laws and think that they can get away with it. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, many do not, and then they're at each other's, they're besides each other's wits about what went wrong. But, you know, you can't play these games because eventually people get caught, and it's that simple. And it doesn't matter who you are and your lifestyle or anything like that, but it just doesn't work. That's the bottom line. It just doesn't work. And that becomes really problematic. All right, let's just see what else is going on. Bear with me a moment. Bear with me a second as we move along here. Okay. One second here. And this is interesting because we normally don't hear about U.S. and Africa as much as we'd like. The U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit took place, and they're forging a better partnership. It seems that the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington this week is a chance for the United States and countries in Africa to move closer to a win-win partnership, analysts are saying. Well, economic and political analysts in Africa say the continent's leaders must push for fair trade deals and better economic partnerships with the United States when they gather in Washington this week. About 50 high-level African delegations are expected at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit convened by the Biden administration. It should not be about just a matter of attending the summit. We should know what we want. We need to tell them that, yes, we are ready to do business with them, said Daniel Amateya Anim, an economist based in Ghana's capital of Accra. Well, negotiating fair deals to improve economies in Africa should be a priority, Anim advised. Political analyst Martin Andati also advised from Nairobi that African leaders should not attend the summit as beggars, quote unquote. They should go in for a form of partnership which creates a win-win situation, he said. The African Growth and Opportunity Act, the AGOA, has been at the core of the U.S. economic policy and commercial engagement with sub-Sahara Africa since 2000. It provides eligible countries in the region with duty-free access to U.S. markets for over 1,800 products. Aneem said that Africa has not explored the potential of the AGOA enough. The program is due to run until 2025, but there are indications that the Biden administration might want to extend it beyond then. Well, U.S. trails China in trade with Africa. But Ndati said that the AGOA had been overtaken by developments in Africa, including the African Continental Free Trade Area, the AFCFTA, the largest of its kind in the world, which came into effect on January 1 of 2021. And in addition, China's engagement and influence in Africa have grown and overtaken that of the United States. Absolutely amazing. So AGOA is no more effective like it was under President Bill Clinton. It had a big impact then, but now most things which are being exported are not even produced on the continent. The raw materials are coming from China, Ndati had said. China's foreign direct investment in Africa is nearly double that of the United States. The Asian giant is also the largest lender around the continent. According to the United States Congressional Research Service, Chinese deals with 632 businesses in Africa totaled, are you sitting down for this, $735 billion in 2020. The previous year, 800 trade and investment deals across 45 countries were valued at $50 billion. So from $50 billion to $735 billion. So the Congressional Research Service data also shows that the U.S. invested $22 billion in 80 companies in Africa over the same period. So the U.S. has repeatedly warned Africa over its engagement with China and Russia. The matter is expected to come up at the summit this week. Chinese have overrun the Americans, and now the Western world, led by the United States, is trying to find a way of getting back into Africa to be able to have its presence felt, Ndati had said. So at a media briefing last week, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for African Affairs, Chidi Blyden, said that the United States would have to review its position on Africa and the kind of partnerships it can establish. We have been told by our African partners, and we completely agree, that they don't want to have to choose between working with the United States, other international partners, and China, and we respect that, he said. I'm open to understanding more about what our African partners need, and we'll learn a little bit of that from the Africa Leaders Summit. Blyden added that U.S. officials meeting with African leaders would be listening and understanding where we can fill in the gaps or where we can work and complement other partners that they're working with to include China. So Daniel Amateya Aneen suggested that Africa could exploit the U.S.-China-Russia divide. In fact, the United States are not too comfortable with China and with Russia's presence on the continent, so we should use it as a tool to attract more funding. Well, Ndati said that the issue of security, especially in the regions of the Great Lakes, the Horn of Africa, and Sahel, should be discussed at the summit. The Americans are very keen, especially in the Horn of Africa, where they have a certain interest. Stability in Somalia has affected the way the Americans do some things, he advised. Well, Blyden said that the U.S. did not want to focus entirely on a military approach to ending security crises on the continent. We're trying to learn from past efforts in the Sahel and ensure that we have engagement, partnership, and collaboration with our African partners to do this. So the first U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit was held in 2014. Energy, trade, financial services, climate change, food security, and healthcare were some of the issues discussed. Similar matters are on the summit scheduled this year, with an even greater emphasis on bilateral trade and investment initiatives. seems the African Union, the AU, this week said that the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit would include new initiatives to increase U.S. engagement with the AFCTA. It noted that talks would center on initiatives to boost Africa's recovery after the pandemic, bolster food security, and promote investment in infrastructure, heal, and renewable energy projects. While certain countries have not been invited to the summit, the White House named them as Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Sudan, and said they were excluded because the African Union had suspended them over recent coups. Eritrea has also been excluded since it has no diplomatic relations with the United States. Well, the delegations due in Washington on Tuesday include the heads of state of key countries such as Nigeria, Uganda, Kenya, and Angola, chairman of the African Union Executive Body, Moussa Faki Mahamat, also will attend. So this is going to be very, very interesting. We'll learn more about what transpired today, tomorrow. So we'll see what happens. And that's going to be very, very encouraging, to say the least. Okay, bear with me a moment as we move on to other things. One second. One moment here. Okay. Again, we're going to move on to technology. So the question is, how does gas storage work? And this is really important. See, now that Germany is no longer getting gas from Russia, its own gas storage facilities are playing an important role. Where is the gas now coming from, and how is it being stored, and what happens when it runs out? It's a major, major concern, and we'll have to see where that goes. Bear with me a second. I think we have a video on this which we can play for you. That's 4 minutes long.
Facilities never attracted much attention before. Now they're at the center of public debate, and for good reason. The country's energy security depends on them this winter. For German businesses like this brick factory in Bavaria, production is dictated by the levels of Germany's gas reserves.
That's a major thing. We check that almost every day, and it's how we run our business here. We need it.
Without gas, the ovens here stay cold.
The gas goes through these yellow lines, right through here, into the oven, and then it heats inside the bricks. You can see the fire. It fires the bricks, so the bricks burn.
Full reserves ensure steady brick production, even during the winter months when Germany imports less gas than it uses. Just a few kilometers from the brick factory in Wolfersberg lies Germany's deepest gas storage facility. It's a porous rock gas storage. What's above ground is just the tip. The most important part lies 3,000 meters below. There, the gas is stored in porous rock that's millions of years old. It soaks up the gas like a sponge. Impermeable rocks and water around it act like a natural barrier and prevent leaks. The gas levels are closely monitored at all times.
Today, we're at 99.2%. It takes about 150 days to fill or empty this storage facility.
It's not just a long process, it's also a complicated one. And it all begins with a big pipe.
This is where the gas comes in during the summer and where it goes out during the winter. In the past, the gas mainly came from Russia. But now, our readings tell us that the gas isn't coming from Russia anymore. It's either coming from Norway or from LNG.
In order to squeeze as much as possible into the storage facility, the gas is compressed. Meaning these giant machines crank up the pressure before the gas can be injected into the ground. Pressurizing the gas causes it to heat up, so it's cooled before continuing on into the underground reservoir.
The Earth goes 2,900 meters below ground.
Then, after a long travel through the pipes, the gas arrives at its destination.
This is the gas storage. This is the rock that forms the actual reservoir. It has a lot of internal surface area because it's so porous. The gas is stored in these pores at high pressure.
When demand outstrips daily supply, gas is withdrawn from this rock, reheated, and depressurized. Then it leaves the facility. This way, the Wolfsberg gas storage could supply up to 300,000 households with gas for 1 year, most of the time.
The uneasy question in the back of my mind is, what if we have a really cold winter? Because if it's really cold, we'll have problems, even when the reservoir is full.
That could see flames go out and factories close, despite Germany's state-of-the-art storage facilities.
Well, very, very interesting as all these things work out, but it's truly amazing how much is accomplished. I never you would, well, I don't have the intellectual capacity to have thought this stuff up on my own, but it's just absolutely brilliant work. Amazing, literally amazing. All right, let's just go check up and see what else we have here for you. One second here. All right, let me see if we can get here to these pages. Okay, one moment. And it's here. I think I pressed the wrong buttons. Okay. I've been to Democratic Republic of Congo, and unfortunately, I read today that dozens have been killed in floods in the Democratic Republic of Congo's capital of Kinshasa. So at least 55 people died in the Democratic Republic of Congo's capital of Kinshasa today in floods triggered by torrential rain. City Police Chief General Silvano Kasongo had said in a statement giving a provisional toll, but it also inflicted several property, inflicted major property damage, submerging the main streets in the city center for several hours. So we'll learn a lot more by tomorrow because this just broke out today, basically, and it's very, very frightening. Beautiful, beautiful country, and but at the same time, very, very backward in so many ways, but just a breathtaking place to visit. Okay, so now let me just quickly look at some other things here, which I think you may find interesting. Where are we? This is important because everybody's listening to and watching the soccer. Soccer teams and how they're doing. Evidently, Croatia beat Brazil on penalties to reach the World Cup semifinals. Wow. The Croatia battle past tournament favorites Brazil 4-2 on penalties on Friday. And to reach the World Cup semifinals following a 1-1 draw over 120 minutes. So we're going to have to see where things go from here. Croatia was looked much sharper and better than the Brazilians somehow, and that's the way it goes. So we'll see. There'll be more games this week, and we'll see where that leads us to, because it's going to be very, very interesting to say the least. Okay, well, let me just quickly look here. There's more stuff around the world.
So hopefully we can catch up with you. 1 minute here. Well, this is very interesting when it comes to soccer. World Cup 2022, Argentina's Barras Bravas bring the noise, evidently, as Argentina have penetrated deeper into the tournament. La Albiceleste support in Qatar has changed, and reports suggest that elements of the country's notorious Barras Bravas are making their presence felt. As Lionel Messi and his Argentine teammates conducted a lap of honor after their quarterfinal penalty shootout victory over the Netherlands, they were serenaded by a melody which is increasingly becoming the soundtrack of the 2022 World Cup. On Argentina Nasi Tierra Diego y Lionel, sang the massed ranks of blue and white clad supporters who made up the overwhelming majority of the 88,000 inside the stadium, many twirling their jerseys rhythmically above their heads. Born in Argentina, the land of Diego and Lionel. Argentina is very much the land of Diego, Maradona, and Messi, the images of the nation's two football demigods adorning the fans' flags, banners, and T-shirts make that clear enough. But Argentina is also the country of the Barras Bravas, the hardcore supporter groups responsible for the breathtaking atmospheres and unique fan culture which have characterized Argentinian football over the last century just as much as Maradona and Messi. And now, in a notable demographic shift at the World Cup, the Barras Bravas, which roughly translates as brave gangs, also appear to be stamping their rather more raucous mark on Qatar, and a tournament which has otherwise been notable for its more gentrified and consumerist fan behavior. With most tickets in the group stage ranging from $69 to $220, increasing to $205 to $425 in the quarterfinals, starting at an obscene $605 for the final, the World Cup is generally only accessible to the well-heeled global middle class. It's a demographic hardly renowned for passionate, raucous atmospheres, with the honorable exception of Morocco. But that seemed to change during the pulsating quarterfinal between Argentina and the Netherlands, where thousands of Argentinian supporters could suddenly be seen standing on their seats behind each goal and indeed on the walls of the stands themselves, fanatically encouraging their compatriots on the field. I can't explain this to you because you won't understand, they sang. How many years I've cried over the finals we have lost, looking back on painful defeats against Germany in the World Cup final in 2014 and Chile in the final of the Copa America in both 2015 and 2016. For Argentinian daily La Nación, it was the culmination of a Develop paper has been steadily observing since Argentina's opener against Saudi Arabia, where Argentine fans from India and the subcontinent, many residents in Qatar, originally made up a large proportion of the support. But since then, there has been a change in the behavior of Argentine fans, whose drums, incessant encouragement, and flags are familiar to our domestic football. The paper wrote last week asking, are the Barras in Qatar? Well, as football fan culture expert James Montague writes in his 2020 book, 1312, among the ultras, the Barras Bravas have loosely existed as rowdy, semi-organized groups of supporters since the 1920s, but became much more structured and hierarchical in the late 60s and 70s when clubs recognized that the passionate support could be harnessed for an advantage on the field. According to Montague, Argentinian governments have even been known to support a key Baras leaders financially, either explicitly or more clandestinely, to get them out to World Cups and help build the atmosphere. But that's not the case this year. On the contrary, according to La Nación, the Argentine Ministry of National Security passed on to the Qatari authorities a list of about 7,000 Baras members who were not to be issued the HAYYA card, the mandatory ID required for fans at the World Cup. With many Baras often synonymous among the general public with football-related violence and organized crime, the Argentinian Ministry for Security, Aníbal Fernández, has reportedly identified the idea of a Baras-free World Cup as a key element of this of his election campaign. So nevertheless, the Argentinian authorities cannot prevent fans from traveling if they don't have criminal records, and La Nación reports that elements of Baras attached to several Argentinian clubs, including Boca Juniors, Vélez, and Racing Club, are present in Qatar riding. They have traveled separately and gathered together on game days. Most of them are staying in Barwa, a neighborhood on the outskirts of Doha, where Argentines with on a low budget, a low cost budget of spending the World Cup. So for Montague, who has just spent 2 weeks in Qatar, the shift in demographic is not a surprise. When a South American team goes a long way in a World Cup, fans make huge sacrifices and travel in huge numbers to support them. Of course, the demographic does skew towards those who have more money, but that doesn't mean the poorer or more working class fans don't find ways to get there. People literally sell everything to go. They sell their cars, they sell their fridges, the refrigerators. There's a mentality among certain fans in South America that if your team is going a long way in a tournament, you just get there and work the rest out later. It's a unique type of support. It's not only unique, it's fiercely independent, it's active, it's passionate, it's unconditional, it's an expression of a living subculture, warts and all. For all their sides, the Baras Bravas also represent the sort of organic football support which would appear, well, it would appear that FIFA and Qatar don't want at the World Cup, where fans or customers in their eyes are expected to immediately attend fan zones and be passively entertained by pre-match light shows, pop music, and countdowns to kick off. According to Ignacio Candia, National Director of Security for Sports Events with the Argentine Federal Police, who has been in Doha for the duration of the tournament and who was quoted by La Nación, the Qatari authorities have been most irritated by Argentinian fans taking off their shirts during games and gathering behind the goals, often stood on seats which aren't technically theirs, and their drums and flags. It's a clash of worlds, but the Baras will be there again when Argentina faces Croatia in the first semifinal today, towering above the field at the Lusail iconic stadium like a blue wave, gathering pace and momentum and volume, and in the belief that after decades of disappointment, this could finally be their year. Boys, now we're dreaming again. They'll sing, waving their arms in unison. I want to win it for the third time. I want to be world champion. Diego, we can see him up in heaven cheering on Lionel. Unbelievable passion. The Argentines seem to be the ultimate in their enthusiasm. They've been doing this for years. It's absolutely breathtaking, actually, when you think about it. Really, really exciting. You know, at least I find it so. So hopefully you will as well. Now, let's just quickly look at some other things here. One second. All right, let me just see if I can get through to this. One moment. All right, I think that we'll be able to get this here for you. This is really quite interesting, which I hadn't expected. Seems that the Royal Marines, English Royal Marines, deployed on a high-risk covert operation in Ukraine. The Royal Marines have taken part in covert operations in Ukraine, a senior general had admitted for the first time. I think Lieutenant General Robert McGowan said the commandos supported discrete operations in a hugely sensitive environment. He said their mission carried a high level of political and military risk. So McGowan is a former a Commandant General of the Royal Marines, and he's joined the Royal Navy's elite unit in 1989. So we'll see where all that goes. So we'll learn a little bit more about what happened here tomorrow, and see where that goes. Bear with me a moment here. Let me just see if we've got this here covered. Okay. Let me just see if we've got this here. Actually, I think that we've reached the end of the line here today. I don't have any other news to share with you today. So we'll just have left to wait for tomorrow. I probably lost quite a bit of stuff here that well, this is really quite interesting because I didn't expect this in looking on what's happening on the world stage. Trans women can take seats on public boards set aside for women, the Scottish judge has ruled. And that's really fascinating. Trans women can take seats on public boards set aside for women, a Scottish judge ruled. Guidance that extends definition of woman to transgender women with gender recognition certificate is lawful, the court said. Wow. So this is huge. And it's going to be very interesting to see where all this goes at the end of the day. So in Scotland's highest court has ruled that transgender women should be included in legislation aimed at improving gender balance on public boards. The Court of Session found that Scottish government guidance that extends the definition of woman to transgender women with a gender recognition certificate, a GRC, is lawful. The ruling dismissed a second judicial review of the Gender Representation on Public Boards of Scotland Act of 2018 brought by the campaign group for Women Scotland. While the legislation has been the subject of a long-running court action by the group, which resulted in a ruling on appeal earlier this year that the legislation should not have been included, transgender women in its definition of woman, as this conflated, quote-unquote, two distinct groups that are protected in law. But Lady Haldane on Tuesday dismissed the latest challenge, accepting the argument brought by Scottish government ministers that it was clear that the United Kingdom Parliament had intended the 2004 Gender Recognition Act to enable a person to legally change their sex, quote, for all purposes, end quote, and that person would then be entitled to the protection of sex under the Equality Act of 2010, which the guidance refers to. So in her judgment, she stated that the meaning of sex, quote unquote, for the purposes of the 2010 Act is not limited to biological or birth sex, but includes those in possession of the GRC. She added that this need not conflict with other legislation. For example, another recent Hollywood law about sexual assault victims' choice of medical examiner, where it is clear sex does not mean biological sex. She also stressed that sex and gender reassignment were, quote, separate and distinct, end quote, protected characteristics under the Equality Act, but nor were they necessarily mutually exclusive. Haldane insisted her ruling on a narrow point of law could not take in the contentious social policy debate, quote unquote, ongoing in Scotland around transgender rights, with the Scottish government's gender recognition reform bill due for its final reading at Holyrood next week. The proposals to simplify how transgender people can change the sex on their birth certificate have encountered heavy criticism from the United Kingdom government, the EHRC, and the United Nations, expressing their huge disappointment at the ruling. For Women Scotland said there were, quote, clear ramifications, end quote, for the bill. Quote, at first reading, this seems disastrous for women who are seemingly now no longer recognized in law as a sex class with distinct requirements of their own. It is now beyond doubt that the bill is not a simple administration change, but does have a wider impact on society. And other equality groups are equalities groups and the Equality and Human Rights Commission said that the ruling confirmed the status quo. Vic Valentine, the manager of Scottish Trans, said, quote, this ruling does not affect the exceptions in the Equality Act, which means that single-sex services can exclude trans people or treat them less favorably where it is a proportionate means to a legitimate aim. They can do that whether or not the trans person has a GRC. A spokesperson for the EHRC, which was named as an interested party in the judicial review, said, quote, the law concerning matters of sex and gender can be complex, and clarity is essential for the public bodies, employers, service providers, and people across the country who rely upon it. Today's judgment supports our understanding that the effect of a gender recognition certificate is to change a person's legal sex, including purposes of the Equality Act. So a Scottish government spokesperson said, we are pleased to note the outcome of that challenge. Unbelievable. So, well, we've certainly reached a point, which is amazing. Wow. Okay. I think we've covered that. And I think that that's it for us today. Well, tomorrow's another day. Tomorrow will be Wednesday. There'll be a lot of news that began today that we'll probably have completion on tomorrow. And we hope you'll be able to join us then. So I think that that's it. All right. Well, we'll wish you a good day. I wish you a goodbye. And we thank you for being with us. Take care and be well. Bye.